Hey, Unchained listeners. As you know, it's hard keeping up with the fast-paced world of crypto, so we've got just the thing for you. Subscribe to our free Unchained Daily newsletter at unchainedcrypto.substack.com. You'll get the latest crypto news and original articles from our reporters, as well as summaries of other happenings in bullet points, plus our meme of the day, all curated and written by our amazing team. It's still your no-hype resource for all things crypto, just in newsletter form. Sign up at unchainedcrypto.substack.com. Again, the URL is unchainedcrypto.substack.com. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Unchained, a podcast engineered by Fractal Recording and produced by me, your host, Laura Shin, a Forbes contributor covering cryptocurrencies and blockchain. Thanks for tuning in. I've been getting some really helpful feedback on Unchained. If you haven't already, please send me your thoughts on what I could do better with the show. It's anonymous, so feel free to say what you really think could be improved. Go to surveymonkey.com/r/unchained or find the link in the show description of this episode. Again, that's surveymonkey.com/r/unchained. I've been to some blockchain conferences recently and have gotten some really nice comments from you listeners, so thank you. But I've also realized a lot of people in the community still don't know about Unchained. Help get the word out about the show by sharing it on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, or with friends and colleagues. And if you have a chance, give the show a rating or review on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, or iHeart. Big thanks to our sponsor, OnRamp. Branding isn't just a logo. Your brand is the essence of who you are and what you offer your customers. OnRamp, which has done great websites for some blockchain companies, is a full-service creative and design agency that provides its clients with concise and exceptionally designed branding, websites, and marketing materials. Connect with your audience. Expand your business. Check out thinkonramp.com. My guest today is Vinny Lingam, four-time entrepreneur, the founder and CEO of blockchain identity startup Civic, a shark on South Africa's Shark Tank, and a Bitcoin Foundation board member. And Vinny's also been nicknamed the Bitcoin Oracle for his uncannily accurate Bitcoin price predictions. Welcome, Vinny.
Thank you, Laura. Good to be on the show.
So heads up, everyone, that we are on the 44th floor of a hotel, the Marriott Marquis, where Consensus was held. And despite our kind of like perch over the city, you might occasionally hear sirens in the episode. Just want to warn you. So, Vinny, you made a number of big announcements here at Consensus, but let's start with the basics. What does Civic do?
Thanks, Laura. So, Civic is a blockchain-based identity platform. What that really means is that we've used the blockchain to reimagine how identity would work in the real world. And we're doing it by giving people the ability to store their personal information, their ID information, and anything really around personal data, health records, etc., on their mobile device, secured by the biometric tools like Touch ID that's on the mobile device, and no one else gets to see the information unless they explicitly give permission for it. And so that means that information is not stored on Civic servers. It's a fully decentralized model. Everyone in the world could be storing their personal information on their devices, and we would have none of it. So we can't get hacked, and you can't lose your information through Civic because we don't store any of that data. And we're doing that because we think it's important that people have control of their information and then can use it to gain access to places where they need to go. So potentially through an airport or going online, logging into a website, replacing two-factor authentication, etc. So we see a ton of use cases. What we've done is we've just launched our product, which allows you to log into websites using your phone, scanning a QR code, passwordless entry, and ultra secure.
So walk me through what that looks like. Like if you are going to an airport and you need to prove who you are, how does that work?
Sure. So that's kind of the long-term dream we have, is that because the ID information on your phone is so secure and locked down that, you know, governments around the world will start accepting Civic IDs and Civic accounts in the future. We're not there yet. We've just launched. And so right now we're focusing on really the cryptocurrency community, so the web developers, the cryptocurrency sites, and exchanges where instead of having to do KYC, which is know your customer, and where you provide exchanges with your passport, your driver's license, and all these, you know, all this information about them, really, multiple times every time you open up an account, we're trying to make it simple so that you do it once. The information is verified, digitally signed, certified on your device. Private keys are placed on the device, and there's a blockchain. There's a hash on the blockchain, on the Bitcoin blockchain, which confirms that the owner of the key is the owner of the information. So when you go to the next site to sign up, if you've already provided information once, They can trust that the information hasn't been changed, and therefore you can log in and you can sign up and not have to go through a full KYC again. So it's really more of a reusable KYC model, but it also means you can just log into websites as a, without a username and password. And by having the app and authenticating through the app, you could gain access. And the good thing about that is because the sites that integrate with us are not storing a username and password for you or an email address and password, if they get hacked, the hacker can't use that information elsewhere to gain access to your other accounts.
One thing was, so you were talking about KYC, which is know your customer. Mm-hmm. So what information is it that consumers need to give when they're signing up for Civic?
So when you sign up for Civic, you can there are multiple levels of accounts. The basic account really is just email and phone number. And that's not a verified account. That's just a basic Civic account. That also means that when you go somewhere, people don't have to send you an email where you have to type in the code or click the link. They don't have to send you a text message, you type in the code again. It's already done. So the website who receives that information from you knows that Civic is verified, that that's your email, that's your phone number, and if, as long as you're willing to give that information to them, they don't have to have you re-verify it.
Wait, so that's like if you travel and you want to check your bank balance or something at the moment, then your bank knows that it's still you, or?
With Civic, there's two types of accounts. You have a basic account where we only verify the email address and the phone number, and then you have a verified account where we verify your email address, your phone number, your address, your first name, middle name, last name, your social security number, and really any other information that the website may need about you. And so verified accounts are a very high level of trust. And basic accounts have got some degree of trust because that's just an email and a phone number. But in both cases, when you're logging into a website, they can choose what information they want from you and what level of trust that they really want from Civic to verify if you are who you say you are.
So which types of accounts would I use, just like the basic account to log in with? Mm-hmm. And then which type of accounts would I use the verified account with?
So if you're applying for a bank account, you would probably need a verified account because no bank is just going to accept a phone number and email address. They want to know that your first name, last name matches, your email address matches, your physical address, social security number, etc. So if we can provide them with that information as being already verified, it makes it a lot cheaper and easier for them to open the account for you versus having to go through an entire process where you have to submit driver's license potentially and passport information. And that's what you have to do right now for exchanges. And so we're trying to make it a lot more easy and more secure to do that.
And then when would I use the basic account with just the email address and phone number?
So for basic accounts, if you were signing up for a social network website or something, you know, that doesn't really require a high degree of knowledge, you know, creating an account on a forum, etc., they just really maybe even want just your email address. And the best part about the basic accounts is they can also be used for something called private logins. And that means that the site accepting a private login will take no information from you at all. So you can sign up for an app or website, give them nothing except a unique token so that they'll remember you when you come back, but they don't know your email or your phone number, and you can test the service out. And if they decide in the future, well, you know, after 7 days of a free trial maybe, we now need to know your email address, the phone number, they can then request it from you at that point, and then you can decide whether you want to disclose the information. So, I mean, I think I'm one of many people who have a problem going to these sites and apps and having to sign up and give all my information just to check out an app. And so we think that the Civic protocol makes it really easy for people to just try things out. And if they don't like it, they can, you know, they can leave and the site can't contact them, has no information.
So at the moment of onboarding, how does Civic know that I'm really who I am? Like, what if I'm a fraudster trying to impersonate, you know, my target?
Right. So in terms of onboarding, we've been doing this for a while. So last year we launched an identity theft protection product, which allows us to really verify your identity. And we've been testing this and a lot of success in making sure that we can verify people's information. So yes, it's entirely possible someone who can fake being you and they can come in into your information, but they'd have to, you don't have to have access to your email most likely and your phone number. There have to be some records matching. We send a postcard to your house to make sure that you actually live at that address. It's got to match public records. So we go through quite an extensive verification process. And we adapt that process based upon country we go into and public record availability. But by and large, the process we go through is the same process that banks and exchanges go through already. So all we're doing is we're making sure that to a high degree we can validate that you are who you say you are. And it may not be 100%, but it's going to be a lot better than a light touch background check.
What types of partners do you envision, and like how will you get them to adopt Civic?
So that's one of the reasons why we're doing a token sale. We felt that Civic needs to be something which is a community-based movement, and we wanted to create a platform where people can really get involved and help us, you know, change the world and make ensure data privacy and security. And it's really it's a fundamental tenet of, I think, you know, the cryptography world and this freedom of information and this knowledge of how unsecure our data is everywhere. And so by structuring the token sale in such a way where you can get tokens as part of the network, so we're issuing 1 billion tokens, they'll be used for smart contracting and data transfers, etc., and many other things. But in order to get tokens, you can do two things. You can buy them in the token sale, or you can earn them. So as a developer, if you choose to integrate Civic, you will be receiving tokens for driving traffic, getting people on board, and depends on the partnership we have, you will earn free tokens and be part of the network. And obviously, we only have a fixed number of tokens, so it's going to go to the people early on who help us build the network and get to scale. And that's one of the best reasons I think we've thought about in terms of reasons for why a token sale makes sense. How do you involve the community? So Civic will own 1/3 of the tokens and 2/3 will be sitting in the community. And people can choose to buy or earn or both.
And so I understand how you're going to use the tokens to build the network, but then like once the network's kind of like sufficiently large enough, what will the tokens have a function then?
Well, the tokens have a function effectively from day one. Once we launch the marketplace, because the tokens act as a smart contracting system. So right now, Civic is the only ID verification service in the network, so to speak. So we're the ones doing the verification. But the plan and the partnerships we're busy forging right now are for large institutions to come in. They may have 10, 20 million customers and give their customers their data and allow that customer to use it on other websites through the Civic network. And those websites who then receive the data can validate it, that it was validated by let's say, for example, a bank. If a bank gave you your personal information on their app or through Civic, said, look, you can now use this, Laura, to log into a website or to open up a securities account or to, you know, apply for medical insurance, whatever it is, you could have a situation where the recipient, so let's say, for example, it's a different financial institution, says, well, we trust this bank, and instead of us doing a whole process on you and spending $10, $20, they're asking for a $1 fee or a 50-cent fee. We're going to pay them that $1 fee, and we're going to let you open the account instantly because the keys match, your information matches. We're pretty certain that that's you.
So then you basically have both of these banks as your partner.
Right.
And you're kind of like the facilitator of ensuring that the information from the first bank is all kosher. Sure. and that okay, it matches what the second bank would require.
Exactly. And so you take it to the next level. I mean, when you have multiple institutions in this platform, you can drive the costs of KYC and ID verification right down. I mean, right now, the world's spending tens of billions of dollars on verifying the same people over and over and over. And if we make it reusable, it can be a lot more simpler, easier, faster, and more secure.
And then to go back to how you were saying the tokens can be used in smart contracts, mm-hmm. What's an example of what that would look like?
So let's say, for example, your profile may have, it's called attestations. So it may have three companies. One bank would say, this is Laura and we verified the social security number. You may have a health record. You may have two or three other bits of information. Who knows? And when you do a transaction with another organization and they need to get some of this information from you, there needs to be a way of settling the smart contract would ensure that the person who verified the information gets paid for verifying the information.
Oh, I see.
And it may have to be split between multiple parties, and they have different they're in different countries, so there may be different currencies and etc. So and then the contract has to execute so in a way that's private, because you don't want necessarily the one party to know where your attestations came from, because there's a privacy issue there. So the smart contracting system is basically ensuring that when a transaction happens, that the tokens get split up between the right parties, there's a transaction happens, the data is handed over, it's verified, it's checked, and it's all done and secure, and a settlement of tokens happens on both ends.
What's interesting about what you're saying is that in this case, these are like B2B payments, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But your token sale is going to be to the crowd. So at what are the ways in which the tokens kind of move between consumers and and the business layer. Where is the B2C aspect?
So the B2C aspect for consumers is there'll be services that Civic will provide. So background checks, maybe credit reports. We do ID verification protection services right now. And you could pay for those services using these tokens. We would accept these tokens as a way of paying for services that we're offering the consumers on our network as well. But it's largely focused on the B2B. It's largely focused on developers. Because think about it this way. If you have tokens which operate in the network and we write smart contracts which you want to execute and you want to lower your KYC costs, you find other companies that are willing to accept these tokens and execute the smart contracts with them on the network using the tokens.
So you're hoping a lot of developers buy in your ICO?
Well, they don't have to buy. They just need to sort of develop on our platform and integrate with Civic and integrate with our network.
And then the tokens, they don't necessarily need to own them themselves?
No, so part of the early adoption cycle is getting, especially the crypto community, developers behind us and integrating and help contributing to building Civic and building the network. And by doing that, we will allocate tokens to them.
Okay.
So that part of the, you know, one third, one third, one third is a third of the tokens are going to be given away for partners who come on and strengthen the network by bringing users on board, by bringing integrations, ways of transferring data, etc. So, yeah, if we had partners coming on board that had millions of users and wanted to reduce their KYC costs and their verification costs, that would add a tremendous amount of value to the network. So we would give them a grant of tokens based on the volume they're going to build in the network. And so that's how we strengthen the network. So think about the strategic partnerships that would build the network would earn tokens as well.
Oh, interesting. Oh, that's really interesting to give away tokens as part of your business partnerships.
Yeah. And these tokens are valuable because there's a limited amount of them. So if you want to be on the network, you need the tokens. And if you, as a company, come on board early and you get a healthy allocation of tokens, you may never need to pay for KYC services for a long time because you'll also be earning tokens when people are using the data of your existing customer base. So there's a strong incentive for early adopters with what we're doing right now.
Okay. And then how does Civic itself make money? It seems like you're making money from the tokens, but then are you taking cut of the transactions? Or
so we write smart contracts for these tokens. And when you execute these smart contracts, there'll be a percentage of the token that goes to us.
Wait, a percentage of the tokens?
Yeah, so if there's a transaction, if there was a transaction where one token was exchanged for an information exchange, there may be a percentage of that token which would execute to our wallet as part of the transaction.
Okay. Oh, interesting. So one other thing that I was just curious about is you've been active in so many different ways in cryptocurrency, but why did you decide to focus on identity?
So at my previous company, Gift, we found that identity was a massive problem. People were using stolen credit cards. The fraudsters are very difficult to catch. Right? And the reason is because it's not really a card problem. Because the argument from the card networks is that, well, it's card not present, so you can't verify who the person is. And so the merchant takes the charge back and he gets the hit. And that's really the issue is that we haven't really, as a society, solved person not present. So how do you know and how can you digitally confirm someone is who they say they are if they're not physically there? And we've gotten to the point now where, I mean, let's be honest, even if someone's physically there, we've had people walk into banks with a stolen driver's license and pretend to be someone else. I mean, it doesn't work, right? So we need a better solution. And so identity is one problem that hasn't been solved. I think the blockchain is well suited to that, the Bitcoin blockchain and other blockchains potentially as well. We focus on the Bitcoin blockchain. And one of the things that I think we feel strongly about in the company is the sort of bigger, greater mission is that I'd like to see democracy change on Earth. I'd like to see us get a point where voting for a president is inclusive of everyone, not just people who can afford to take the day off and go vote. And I'm from South Africa. I grew up under apartheid. When Nelson Mandela was released, I witnessed how people would stand in lines for days to go vote. And it's kind of crazy, right? So I come from a world where I was born without a vote. and so as a mission, like if I could give voting to the world, it would be amazing. If I could let people vote on their mobile phones in any part of the world where they are, like if you're traveling while your election's on in a country, you can't really participate. There's a way of doing it, but it's really cumbersome. And voting's not secure. I mean, people, elections get hacked. Good luck hacking the Bitcoin blockchain, So if we could get to the point where you could use tokens as a way of voting, if you could use, Bitcoins or any other crypto to vote, it would be very interesting because the results would tabulate in real time. You'd have, you'd have results. You'd have guaranteed no double spend, guaranteed no double votes, etc. So that was like the origin for the company, Civic. And then we thought about the problem more and more, and we realized to solve that problem, we actually have to solve identity first. And because when I spoke to lawmakers around voting, digital voting, sure, the technology exists, and you can argue that current tech is pretty bad, and it's prone to hacking. And yeah, blockchain tech is great, but the real issue is that I think lawmakers just don't have faith in the fact that identity is digitally secure and sound. And so they would not be willing for years. I mean, the one conversation I had with a state representative was that, yeah, well, we could probably get there in about 8 to 10 years' time. And that's probably about right. But in between now and then, you've got to get to the point where digital identity is actually solved. So then it becomes kind of a no-brainer to use a way of digitally voting. And so that's kind of a long-term vision for the company.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Oh, interesting. And on the back end now, are you using Bitcoin or Ethereum or a private chain?
We're using Bitcoin. We felt Bitcoin was the most secure and non-partisan type of coin out there. It's global. You know, it's in every country. The nodes are propagated everywhere. It's you know, obviously there's a pending hard fork that may be coming soon. There's some other issues there, but we think that the long term, the security, and it's more the neutrality of Bitcoin kind of serves the purpose for voting versus having, you know, for example, we could go with Ethereum, but then, you know, there actually are the personalities behind Ethereum, and there's a foundation, and there's some form of centralization there if you think about it. Whereas Bitcoin, I mean, you know, sure, you have core developers and you've got mining centralization, but largely I think everyone realizes that Bitcoin is something which is just purely, you know, the technology itself is neutral. So there's no argument from one government that it would not be, it can be taken over by another government necessarily. And I think we would have a bit of an arms race if that happened, because everyone sees Bitcoin as a global asset versus controlled by one person or persons right now. I mean, you could argue otherwise, but I think to a large extent, I think it's pretty neutral.
A lot of these token launches are happening on Ethereum, but are you doing yours on Bitcoin?
So we'll be issuing a pre-token using Ethereum, ERC-20. That's because the smart contracting system is not ready and the marketplace is not ready. Obviously, we're rolling that out now, but it'll be ready in about, I would say, conservatively, I'd say Q1, and we expect to have it ready by then. But the reason we're doing that, we're not necessarily using ERC-20 going forward long term, is that we've built on Bitcoin. So when we saw what RSK was doing and with smart contracting and on Bitcoin, and because our systems are built on Bitcoin, it just makes more sense for us to use RSK and not have to try and, you know, integrate into Ethereum and have a bridge between
the
two.
The RSK, when is that launching?
Well, they're already live on the testnet right now, and it seems like everything's going well. So I think, you know, in the next couple of months, we'll have something there, and then we'll test it. And as long as we feel that it's secure and robust, we'll roll it out with them. We should be the first token sale and that runs on RSK. We're confident that they can pull it off. But we, you know, for now, we're going to issue an ERC-20 token, and we'll take it from there.
So, but one thing that you said was you're issuing a pre-token. I don't know what that means.
So a pre-token is basically, look, the token's not going to be functional in the sense that you can't really use it for the smart contracting because it hasn't been built in. We haven't written the smart contracts for the ERC-20 token, but you'll be able to, at the time, exchange that for the final token. And for some reason, if we decide to stay with the ERC-20 or there's some issues, we would basically use that token going forward. But we're pretty confident that the RSK team can execute and get us a ready in time to deploy with our platform. So we're expecting to be on RSK and be the first. Okay. And I think it's also good for Bitcoin. I mean, I'm a big Bitcoin believer and supporter. I think Bitcoin is got the power to change the world. And I'd love to see us doing smart contracts on the top of Bitcoin. I'd love to see us using Bitcoin for a variety of different use cases other than, you know, money transfers and payments. And I'd like to see us get there. So we're going to keep pushing on that. And if for some reason we hit a limitation and we just can't make it happen, sure, we'll use other technologies. But for now, I think Bitcoin can get there.
So just a couple more things about this, though. Like, sometimes they say that if you launch a token, you should do it when your network's already functional. So that way it, like, reduces the chance you'll be your token won't be deemed a security. But do you feel like you're running that risk doing it this way?
Not at all. I mean, most people are running token sales and ICOs right now on the back of a white paper with no tech. And we've spent 2 years building our platform nearly. And we've got all the infrastructure up and running. We've got the verification processes. It works. It functions. And so the last part is really writing the smart contracts and integrating it into the back end. So I'd say that the platform is nearly ready, a few more months to go. So I don't think that there's, what we're really selling right now is a product. It's a, you can use the product today. And so we're selling network access to the product where you could start monetizing your customer data and earning revenue from it. And so that network access is what we're packaging as a token and we're selling. So we've also been very, I'd say, circumspect about how we do a token sale versus every other sale out there. And a lot of people have set up offshore companies and foundations and, Virgin Island trusts and whatever, all this fancy, tax structuring, mess. We've thought about this very long and hard. We've spoken to our attorneys, Perkins Coie, have been advising us really well on the process and working with Deloitte as well. And yeah, we could have done all that. We could have gone through this and maybe it would have been okay from a legal perspective. And maybe we could have, saved a whole bunch of money on taxes. But the reality is we're not some sketchy offshore company trying to take, money and hide it from taxes and do all sorts of fancy stuff. We're actually just building cool tech, and we think that we can change the world. And so at the end of the day, we decided to keep it as what we are, a venture capital funded Delaware C corporation with the board, with, all the structures, done this before. We're going to pay the taxes as we need to. The money flows into the company, into the U.S. It's regulated from a, we're a U.S. company, and we're based in Palo Alto. What you see is what you get. We're not going to do anything fancy or crazy. And in doing so, we think, we're going to walk the straight and narrow line, and, maybe we don't save as much or we don't raise as much or whatever it is. But, it's more important that we do it the right way, we think.
Okay. And I also wanted to ask you, why did you not go for VC funding this time? I totally understand the function of the token and all that, but, like, I know, initially you were VC funded.
Well, we are. We are VC funded.
Okay, right. But then now you're choosing to raise money another way. Why did you go that route?
So we've raised, $5.75 million in funding so far. We actually haven't announced all of it, but, I think it should be public by now. And so we've raised that much money. It's a good, healthy amount of money to get a company to the point where you've got a product launch ready. It's a very difficult building tech in our space because, remember, we're dealing with a lot of regulation with regards to identity, consumer information, data. We have to re-architect things. I mean, we've had to re-architect it so we can effectively store everyone's in the world's information on their own devices. And this is a lot of security that goes into that and a lot of thought and tech, and it's taken us a while to build it. So when it came to the next stage, well, we could go raise money from a VC, and let's say we go and raise some money from a VC. What does a VC do for our business, if you think about it? This is a grassroots-level, community-driven thing. I mean, we need lots of small developers, medium developers, cryptocurrency players, exchanges, etc., playing with us. And we need to figure out a way to get these guys incentivized to move to a better, more secure system, because money in the bank itself isn't going to get us there. I mean, you've got to get the community to support this. People need to see this as a better way of logging into websites, protecting data privacy and security. And so, also speaking to VCs, as I do in Silicon Valley, up until a month ago, 2 months ago, Bitcoin, blockchain, it died. I mean, they treated it like 1999, right? Well, 2000, the big bubble crash, and they paid no attention to it. So I spend most of my time in VC meetings educating these guys and having them to bring in more people to educate. And then at the end of the day, I don't think they quite get it. And now they, you know, on a treadmill trying to catch up and figure out what's going on in this ICO space. And it's sad, but it's taken, you know, this is years of experience that people in the crypto community have had understanding this and how it works. And now VCs are trying to play catch up. And so, you know, I'd rather take a view that working with the community and building something which everybody benefits from, and people who understand it, so we're targeting the crypto community first, will become the early adopters, and that would basically then encourage mass market adoption over time because people would understand why this is important and the value. And it's always just better to have, you know, hundreds or thousands of people who are part of a network versus one VC.
This is such an interesting conversation, but we're going to take a break just for a second for an important word from our sponsor, OnRamp. And then we'll talk more about your background before Civic, and also we'll talk more about Bitcoin and crypto in general. With so many companies vying for people's attention now, it's important to stand up from the pack. If you're looking to become a go-to brand that lingers in consumers' minds, check out OnRamp, a full-service creative agency that helps its clients maximize brand awareness, gain market momentum, and accelerate growth. OnRamp has helped numerous companies do everything from create their branding and identity to redesign their existing website to draw more traffic. Plus, they've helped blockchain startups and projects. Whether you're launching your brand or repositioning an existing organization, or just want to freshen your company's look, OnRamp can come up with a tailored design project or a strategic marketing plan that ensures your firm's lead in the market. Learn more and see examples of its work at thinkonramp.com. I'm talking with Vinny Lingam, CEO and co-founder of Civic. So let's go into your background. How did you get into Bitcoin?
So when I was running Gift, my previous company, and we launched in late 2012, we got hit by a ton of credit card fraud. I mean, thousands of dollars. And in some days, like $5,000 in a day from, you know, people overseas and whatnot. And it was tough because you're a startup and you have a very tight budget. We hadn't raised that much capital. And so we had to figure out how do we get past all this fraud and how do we, because the more we turn the fraud filters up, the less sales we had and the more problems we would have with customer support. So it was a fine line trying to balance and making sure chargebacks were not a big issue. And then around January or February of 2012, I think it was January, I started chatting to a friend of mine, one of our, you know, advisors, and he was saying to me about Bitcoin, and I kind of heard about it before when I dismissed it, the usual cycle, and the price is back up again. I was like, okay, let me go buy some. So I wound up buying some coins from Wences, you know, patient zero for Bitcoin in Silicon Valley.
That's Wences Casares, CEO of Xapo.
Yep, and this is back in 2012, and I know Wences for many years because I was part of Endeavor, the Entrepreneur Foundation organization. And so, you know, Wences was, you know, if you know Wences, he was always on fire about Bitcoin. And yeah, I watched the run up to $255 and watched it crash down to like 50. It was a very exciting and interesting time. Did a bit of trading, made some money, lost some money, kind of broke even in the end. But I was hooked. Like, this is going to be the next big thing. And I decided to plug Bitcoin into Gift. And so we worked with Tony Gallippi from BitPay, and we integrated. And my developers thought I was crazy. My VCs thought I was nuts. And I even had bets with one of my developers that we'd have more than $1,000 in sales in the first day. And he didn't believe it, so I won a bottle of wine from him. But we did. I mean, we broke $1,000 in the first day. And eventually, we were doing hundreds of thousands of dollars a month, and eventually millions a month in Bitcoin sales. And so, you know, when we sold the company to First Data, we had grown the business tremendously on the back of Bitcoin, but we already started seeing, you know, more payments through credit cards and PayPal. And this, we took something which is really, but Gift was really a crypto community focused product, and we took it mainstream. So in the end, you know, Gift probably was doing less than 10% of its total volume on Bitcoin. In the beginning, it was doing 95%.
Oh, wow.
But that helped us get all the merchants on board because we had volume, whereas we wouldn't have had volume just on the credit cards. And so Bitcoin was instrumental, actually, in getting Gift from a niche audience to the mainstream audience, where now it's, you know, like probably the biggest online gift card site.
Wait, so I'm so confused by that. Like 95% of the gift cards being bought on Giftware being paid for with Bitcoin?
Initially, because we were just targeting the Bitcoin community, right? So, so we had everyone from the Bitcoin community coming in using us, and it was a way of, you know, using spending your Bitcoins and going shopping and buying stuff at, you know, all the great stores that we had. And it helped us attract more stores because we had this, you know, I'd rather have like 10,000 like super loyal, excited, happy customers than millions of people who don't really do much. And so the thing about the crypto community is they're very passionate. And so when they see a great service, they tell their friends, they get involved. And that's kind of why we're doing the same thing with Civic. We want the community to get involved. I want, you know, a million crypto, you know, enthusiasts to understand the technology and how we're protecting their privacy and their data, telling their friends about it, and taking the product mainstream. So that's why I'm kind of using the lessons I learned from Gift in Civic and engage in the community on this.
And people basically were holding Bitcoin and they couldn't like spend it at Amazon. So what they were doing, or I don't know, who were some of your
Amazon, Starbucks, retailers? Target, we have all those big retailers, still do. And when I say we, Gift does.
Oh, wow. Okay. And so since they wanted to shop at those stores, but they couldn't spend, oh, I see.
Yeah.
Wow.
So we opened up 55,000 retail locations to anyone who held a Bitcoin, really, back in the days. So you could go to any one of the stores, download the Gift app, buy a gift card, and we would have zero fraud.
Oh, wow. Oh, right. And no chargebacks.
And no chargebacks. And so we were very happy to take the money, and our margins were much higher. And then we introduced loyalty points, which incentivized the network even more. And so we built a network effect around that. So we're kind of doing the same thing with tokens. In Civic, we're giving tokens to reward users and partners and making everyone feel part of the network. And so engage in the crypto community with something which they're comfortable with. So tokens, and that's why we're doing the token sale. So this is a natural evolution of what I learned at Gift and applying to Civic, and already within, you know, just announcing the platform and getting out there, the response has been phenomenal.
So let's talk more generally about Bitcoin. Sure. and crypto. I want to talk about your reputation as the Bitcoin price oracle. How did you get into the business of Bitcoin price prediction?
Well, I never got in the business of price prediction. I kind of got dragged into that part. I mean, I was in the business of giving fundamentals and talking about fundamentals and advice. So when I said at the Coin Summit conference in 2014, Bitcoin had gone up, and I was watching the data from the back end at Gift, and I could see when people spend, when they don't spend based upon the price. And so I had a lot of insights that I'd gleaned from how consumer behavior followed the price. And so when I sat down at this conference, I think it was March or April of 2014, everyone was like punch drunk. Like they were, oh, Bitcoin was like $800 or whatever it is, $700, $800. And they all thought it was going to go to 2,000 that year. I asked the whole room and everyone said 2,000. And the funny thing is, like a year before that, I was at the San Jose Bitcoin conference where Bitcoin was $100 or something, and everyone thought it's not going to go up that much. And I said 1,000. So we hit 1,000 the previous year. And I kind of got the, wow, Vinny, how'd you know? And then I said, okay, well, it's going to go down and it's going to go sideways for a long time until these issues resolve. And I pointed out, I wrote a blog post about the fundamentals of people spending the money, merchant adoption, lack of on-ramps for Bitcoin, etc., you know, lack of fiat to buy Bitcoin, etc. And so I was able to make predictions based upon market fundamentals, which I understand, which I communicated in my blog post. And then about 12 to 18 months later, Bitcoin kind of bottomed down to the 200s or around about there, and then it started climbing back up again. And then I felt that, okay, the fundamentals change again. So I wrote another blog post called Bitcoin Awakens, and that was about a year ago at about the 450 mark. And I said all the reasons why I think Bitcoin will go to, you know, over $1,000, you know, in 2016. And basically hit there, I think, within a couple of hours to spare. Depending on which exchange you look at, it was like by New Year's Eve, $1,000. And, you know, along the way, just my tweets, like I was able to call certain, you know, false runs of Bitcoin getting started and whatnot, and having fun with Ryan Selkis, and, you know, because they all thought, oh, this is the next big run, and I was like, no, it's not. And you know, I spoke about the halving and how the effect that would have and how it would go sideways for a while again. So I've made a number of good predictions of Bitcoin. The one prediction which I made, which people kind of, you know, hold me to, is the fact that at 12:50, at the ETF announcement, I said, look, the ETF's not going to happen, which it didn't. And I said, the price is going to tank, and it may not recover very quickly. And I had a price target. I said, look, I mean, it was just a target. It was like, look, on the upside, I think Bitcoin goes to, you know, 2,000 or whatever the number was if the ETF's approved. But if it doesn't, it's going to tank to like 850. And it dropped down to 880. And I actually thought it would go below 850. I think it's maybe, it might even stay there. But my prediction was 850. And I get so much shit for not hitting the 850 number. Like, people don't understand. Like, that was more directional. It was like, hey, it's going to go. The fact that it broke 900 went down is like pretty close.
But to my mind, 850 and 880, that's fine.
Yeah, like, exactly. So then I get a lot of crap on Twitter. I started just muting people because Twitter is not a place for debate.
Oh yeah, no, it's not. I like to read the threads, but I try not to engage too much. But wait, so I want to ask, when you were saying that you felt like the market fundamentals weren't there in 2014, but then things changed. So what are some of the things that did change about? Was it a year ago? Like, what did you see then that you felt like was going to enable the price to rise?
Well, I definitely felt that the halving coming up would have an impact.
Which was like just about a year ago. Yeah. It was like, well, it was 11 months ago or something.
July last year.
Oh, July. Okay. Yeah.
So about a year ago, that would have an impact and would create a spike. There were just a number of other things, like, you know, global markets instability. I wrote about currency, commodity, Bitcoin as a store of value. The one thing I've said to people is that Bitcoin moves up too fast, it's going to create bubbles and crashes. And people don't want to listen, so we're going to be in that phase again. So
is that what you think is going on now?
Well, I did not expect Bitcoin to go over, you know, the 1250, 1300 mark. And if it did, I knew it would run because that's typically what Bitcoin does.
And you didn't think it would go past that?
I didn't think it would go past 1300 this year. Well, until the scaling issue was resolved and the hard fork was resolved. So that's why I didn't believe it. And I also believe that by, you know, the price being kept lower, that we'd have quicker resolution on the scaling debate, because at some point it's not profitable to keep mining. So I had a whole, you know, little bit of a, I went on a limb on that one, but all that happened essentially was the price kept rising and people don't care about the technical fundamentals of Bitcoin, and so now we're in a situation where transactions below $100 don't make any sense because of the fees and it's not in a healthy situation. Everyone knows that. So then the alts are coming in and people are running that, and I don't like to see that. And even though Bitcoin is not, you know, probably double 1250, I mean, I publicly sold at 1250. Because I felt that was a short-term, you know, cap. We've had a run. And the reasons for the run, I'm not so sure are necessarily sustainable. But what it did do is it brought confidence back into the market and the broader markets. And now you have people who have no idea what Bitcoin is buying Bitcoin. And, well, I've seen this story play out before. And we'll see how high it goes before it comes back down again.
And so where do you think this investment is coming from? From people who don't really know what's going on?
Yeah, I think it's from...
And who are they?
Well, I mean, I've had tons of friends contact me. They wouldn't know a Bitcoin from an Ether. like they have no idea what they're doing. And they finish, I buy. I'm like, I'm not giving people advice anymore. I'm just going to sit back and see what happens. And look, the way I look at it is I've always been a level-headed, reasonable person through the years. And when things are like out of whack on the downside, people think I'm crazy. Like, Bitcoin $1,000, are you nuts? Bitcoin going up 3x, are you nuts? And everyone's got different personal risk and appetite. So when it comes to personal risk and appetite, I mean, I had a ton of my net worth, you know, double digits sitting in Bitcoin at 1250, and I just didn't feel comfortable with the way the world was, and I reduced my holdings significantly. I have, you know, I sold like 90% of my coins, but what I have left is still a decent amount of money. But for my personal risk appetite, and now it's effectively doubled, so 20%, whatever it is, you know, it's a decent amount of money, and I'm happy to support Bitcoin, but I wasn't comfortable with the price given the risks. And if you look at, again, the reasons for the run, some of the fundamentals, you've got fiat that can't go into exchanges, you've got, you know, all-time, I mean, right now, and I think Bitfinex, 360% a year interest to lend dollars to people who are going long on Bitcoin.
Oh.
I mean, at some point, this stuff, I mean, I saw this happen in 2013 as well, and it happens, and the stuff unwinds. And so it's kind of like musical chairs. And the music stops. If you don't have a chair, you're going to be, you know,
so you think the bubble's going to pop this year, and what's going to happen?
It may never pop. I mean, it may never pop. The reality is that markets can stay irrational for a long period of time. Look at the traditional financial markets. You've got bonds, which are in a bubble. You've got, there's a lot of, I mean, with capitals cheap worldwide, everything gets inflated. I mean, people in Japan can borrow yen for 0% interest and go buy Bitcoin. So what's going to happen? The price keeps going up. The velocity of price increase is more my concern. The faster it goes up, the faster it can come down. And the other thing which people forget is that when new money comes into the system, these aren't long-term holders. They're people coming in to speculate. They're selling their houses. I'm seeing these stories again, just like we did 4 years ago. And they're putting all their money into Bitcoin.
Really?
Yep. And what happens if the price drops 20%? Well, then it drops another 20 or 30% because people panic sell the market because they're holding too much. And now they can't service their debt. Like, this stuff always ends badly. And so when you look at the market right now, I'm biting my tongue. I'm, you know, kind of like half joking. I bought one ETH at $185 because, like, I told the guy next to me, if I buy one at that price, it's going to tank, right? And it kind of went down. It was a bit of a joke. I think
Now it's up again.
Now it's up again. And the market's just irrational, just largely irrational across the board, right? Like Dogecoin's worth $350 million or something right now.
Right.
So this is, everyone who kind of knows has been around for a while and knows that this is an irrational market. Doesn't mean you can't make money. I think the biggest mistake you make is shorting an irrational market. It's a bad idea. So I'm not shorting. I'm not, you know, going long. I'm just sitting back and waiting to see what happens. I think there's a lot of good crypto projects out there right now, and these projects will deliver real value, but there's a lot of noise, and if you can't see the noise from the signals, you're going to lose some money, and that's the way it is. And I think people need to learn lessons as well. So instead of me trying to tell people, hey, there's a bubble, watch out, I kind of sit back and just to see what happens. And again, I could be totally wrong.
But you think there's going to be a correction? Right now, Bitcoin is above $2,000, like
2,500.
So what do you think would be like a more reasonable price, and kind of like what market fundamentals do you look at to kind of gauge what the value should be, like, and also what risks do you see right now?
It's not a price issue. It's a velocity of value increase. It's the quality of money going into the system versus the total. No one can argue a lot of money is coming into crypto in the past couple of months. It's the quality of money. Are these people long term, or are they just speculators running it up? Are they?
Well, but what about like things like the potential hard fork? I mean,
that's the issue. People putting money in, they don't understand this stuff. And so you got people even in Bitcoin do understand it. Who say, well, a hard fork will be fine. The reality is that even an 80% hard fork is a contentious hard fork. Then you're going to have a split. And then you're going to have Roger, who owns Bitcoin.com and BTC.com and whatever else. And then you're going to have two different flavors of Bitcoin. Oh, all of a sudden, the whole thesis that Bitcoin only has 21 million units. Well, that's probably 42 million. Actually, no, it's 63 million because now there's three chains. Like, this is another conversation that you can have with man on the street who just sees the price going up and wants to buy Bitcoins.
Right.
So this is stuff where Bitcoin can go up to 5,000 from where it is today. It can double. It can triple. The faster it happens, the more likely it's going to crash.
So, and what are the odds, do you think, of a split in Bitcoin where we end up with two coins or three coins?
Much higher than the market's pricing in.
Okay, but you don't want to name odds?
No, I don't think it's up to... I've written blog posts about this. I've said my piece. I'll always be known as the guy who tried to prevent the bubble, and I failed, clearly, because it's going to happen. And I think it's part of the learning cycle. We have to go through these bubbles. I don't think one man can prevent the market from being irrational. And if the bubble never bursts, then that's great. I'm happy for Bitcoin. I have Bitcoins. I'm not going to be complaining about it. But again, I try to be rational. And
okay, so do you think that the odds of a split are more than 50%? Or
this year?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, wow. And so if Bitcoin does split, which chain do you think will take the greater market share or be considered the real Bitcoin?
That one is a very difficult one. That's very, because it, when you say consider the real Bitcoin, by what? By the market? By the price? Based on market cap? Based upon what fundamentals?
The majority of people.
In the whole world? People in China? People in Japan? People in Korea? People in the US?
Yeah, I guess.
So how do you average it out?
Everybody.
Everyone? Well, BitPay themselves have said they would basically have to run two Bitcoins at that point. They'll operate on both chains.
Permanently, though?
Well, for a while. So they would be operating on both chains. It's kind of scary, right? So from some of the consumer tech background, when you go and buy one Bitcoin, you got a gift and you want to go spend the coins there, and now you get told that, oh, you have the wrong Bitcoin. This is just not good for business. It's not good for either Bitcoin. A contentious hard fork is the biggest problem we've got right now. And that was my biggest concern. And I think that it's going to happen. And the market's not pricing it in. And so the moment the market gets spooked that this is actually going to happen, and the moment it gets closer to actually happening, the more we are going to see the bubble, you know, deflate a bit.
Okay.
Maybe temporarily, maybe for a while. I don't know. It's, again, I never gave myself the Oracle name. People call me the Oracle. it's kind of funny. Like, again, I like to be pretty even keeled about these things. So when sentiment's low, I look like I'm positive, and when sentiment's high, I look like I'm negative. And it's all perspective thing, right? So let's see. I want to see us get through this year without a contentious hard fork. And if we do, then I've been totally wrong about everything I'm saying. And if we do have a contentious hard fork this year, then people need to realize that, again, I was the guy who tried to stop it, but no one listened.
Okay. Well, let's talk more generally also about that ICO trend. You kind of made a few remarks earlier that sort of give a hint what you think. But so what would you say is your overall opinion of what's going on right now?
Well, look, I think there's a number of – it's like the dot-com days in a sense, right? There's this new thing. People don't quite understand it. Everyone wants a piece of it. It's like, you know, they're seeing their friends do it and whatever. The dot-com bubble and burst was really bad for a lot of people in a short space of time, but really good for the majority of the world for a long period of time. And so you've got to kind of take the good with the bad. And so when I look at it as Google raised $25 million during the dot-com mania, and we have Google today, thankfully, for a lot of things, right? And so I think that you will get some companies and some organizations that leverage it well and are able to use this current, call it, environment to build amazing services for the world and make a difference long-term. And those will more than pay back all the losses and whatever else, but you're going to get people who are, just like dot-com days, got scammed, and you're going to have these crazy parties that these companies throw, and, you know, in Vegas, and burning $5 million in launch parties. Like, you can have all that crazy stuff happening potentially. You also have the problem that people think that because cryptography and technologies are now distributed around the world, that the culture is the same around the world, around building companies and building organizations. It's not. And so the discipline around building tech companies differs from market to market, and how people spend money, how they behave, how they act, how they hire, how they fire, how they build these services. Now, I think we're a lot more aligned now than we were 20 years ago in terms of the differences between cultures, but there are cultural differences across countries. I mean, I'm South African, I have investments in South Africa, the culture is different there to the US.
So you're saying there. You're saying that because of that, for that reason, then the ICOs in different places some are going to be more scammy, or is that what you're saying?
Potentially, yeah.
Okay.
And look at the culture in Silicon Valley. You know, if founders go out and buy a Ferrari and drive around in the streets, I'm not going to point out examples, but they get hit pretty hard, right? So you don't do that in Silicon Valley. You don't go buy a Ferrari after you get funding or have people walk around in, you know, sneakers and T-shirts. They're a lot more understated. And so it really is about the wealth there. But there are other parts of the world where, you know, it's like founders will go buy the Ferraris and they'll, you know, the culture is to go and, you know, it's less intellectual. And I'm not saying it's everywhere, and I'm not saying every company is the same. But there are certain cultures that it's not about the good you do in the world, the technology you do in the world. It's about you as a founder and your, you know, if you're single, the car you drive and the house you have and the playboy lifestyle. And I see this as I travel around the world and I look at investments and I look at the people behind it. And so the problem with that is that a lot of people around the world are really good at marketing and selling, and not as good as a technology. And I must say, again, not saying Silicon Valley has the monopoly on this. I mean, you've got great companies in every part of the world. But the moment you pull out the bad elements out of certain cultures, don't expect the money to be spent well.
Okay. And also, so what are some of the things going on in the ICOs right now where, like, you look at that and you're like, I wish people would stop that? What are some of those things?
Well, first of all, founders taking money off the table and through a token sale and ICOs is just nuts. Like, teams that want to take that's just, like, I heard a story about that yesterday, and I haven't confirmed it, and if that's the case, and now we're ready, like, that's
crazy. And by that, you mean, like, not putting some of it, just, like, immediately?
Yeah, into their pockets.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that, for me, that's a red flag straight away. I think the notion of uncapped token offerings is a bad idea as well. Mm. I think it sends the wrong signal. I think the Dutch auction system was bad, I think, in my opinion, but markets kind of rewarded Genosis on that, so be it. Yeah, I think it's about being fair. I think about, like, you have to create the value for everyone in the network. And so it depends, like, our goal is to create a network and make sure everyone benefits from the network in you know, in many ways. I don't think everyone else has the same sort of ambition. So some people, this is a get-rich-quick scheme. Some people, basically, because they're outside the U.S., they can do these ICOs under other jurisdictions, and they can take the money and run. And there's nothing you can really do about it. And so the people and the team and the quality of the work and the track record is very important to me. Not to say that people with no track record should be discarded. I mean, the quality of the work. But I think it's you got to find the, I mean, I think people go from one end to the other. They go from the end of, well, if it's a venture-backed company, it must be great, to if it's not venture-backed, it must be crap. Okay? And I think there's a middle ground here. And there's a middle ground where just because a team isn't venture-backed or necessarily have experience, that they couldn't be building something amazing. But there should be some governance structure in place. Some, you know, besides those two guys in a room, who's on their team? Do they have some advisors? Do they have a board member? Do they have someone who is going to, you know, look over them and help them? Is there some pedigree? You know, and sometimes you can just argue, well, it doesn't matter. But when you're building companies and you're building technology companies and startups and you're working with people and you're hiring, and the way you treat your people is important. The way you build the culture is important. The way you try to be non-racist, non-prejudicial, like equal opportunity for women, all these things, I think it's important. I think you can't operate in today's society with the same biases that we've had in the past, and you've got to be a bit more forward-thinking. And sometimes the technologists who sit in the room come up with this stuff, they don't know how to operate these organizations and these businesses. And so you get the situation where, and it's changing now, I mean, Bitcoin's been largely male-dominated. Now, that I don't think it's entirely the technologist's fault. I think it's just a nature of the people who were into crypto or whatever else, and this technology cycle were largely male for whatever reasons. Call it education,
well, society,
education.
Yeah.
So
it shapes boys into, you know, techie, exactly, financial types, and girls into not. So
exactly.
Yeah.
So you can't blame the people necessarily, but then it's also upon us to try and bring in diversity into our organization. So we can't say, well, because society created this problem where it's heavily slanted towards one group, that we can't fix it.
Yeah.
And so I think that's, so again, culture is important. And I think when you're backing a team and you don't know about their views on culture and what they're doing, like I like to look at capital as something which, like, I call it conscious capital. So if I invest in something, I kind of want to believe in the team. I want to believe in what their vision is, their values. These are important things to me. Like, do I want to invest in a team that is, well, I mean, would I invest in a team that's racist? No. Would I invest in a team that's prejudicial towards a certain group? No. Like, so why don't we find these facts out? And the only way you do is, like, by getting to know the people and understanding their vision and what they see and their values. And I think it's a lot easier to align values when you know people versus when you're just reading a white paper.
Oh, wow. So that means that it must be pretty difficult to invest in an ICO then.
I think it is. And I think it's, again, it's sometimes it's investing, sometimes it's buying tokens. Like, you can, there's certain tokens you can easily buy because of what it is, and
right,
it's not really linked to the culture of the company, and it's a distributed model, or lots of developers.
You just open, want to use the service.
People want, exactly. So there's lots of reasons for it. But I think, I look at this as a startup investor. I've done a ton of investing. I've done Shark Tank.
Right.
Like, on Shark Tank, if I don't get a sense of the people, I've got a cultural alignment with my values, I don't invest.
Okay. Yeah, I actually, so we don't have a lot of time left, but I do want to ask you a few,
sure,
remaining questions. So one of them is about Shark Tank. How did you get on that, and how has that experience been for you?
So yeah, that was a great experience. I was invited to be on Dragon's Den, which is like the UK and Canadian version of Shark Tank.
Okay.
3 years ago in South Africa, and I went on it. It was a great experience. And then Sony owns the rights to Dragon's Den, so they brought out Shark Tank in South Africa, and myself and the other dragon were selected to be sharks as well. So it was great. And Shark Tank is one of my favorite TV shows in the US, and I've been watching it for years, so I really enjoy it. I sit in Mark Cuban's seat.
Nice.
And I get to see all these South Africans pitch ideas. And one of the deals we did was Augmentors, which was on the show, and these guys came and they were trying to, like, figure out how to monetize this thing. And I was like, guys, why don't you just use, like, the blockchain, and why don't you create the rarity of these items? And so they did an ICO, and they sold $1 million worth of tokens, and now it's, I mean, literally up, like, the database up 20x.
Oh, wow.
And so, I mean, again, the market's frothy, to say the
right,
least, so everything's up 20x. But
right,
but it was interesting that we were able to take something on Shark Tank. I did the first ever Bitcoin deal on Shark Tank.
Oh, That's great.
And I was wearing my Bitcoin socks at the time as well.
Oh, nice.
It was a good experience and, again, met some interesting people.
What other projects and tokens are you interested in?
I mean, Shark Tank, I kind of had to talk about Databits and whatever else because it was a TV show, a broadcast. I couldn't hide the fact that I was behind it. But I actually never talk about what I like and what I don't like publicly because I do have a large audience on Twitter and a large following. So if I say XYZ coin is going to be big, it's the price will just move and people will buy because I said so. And I just don't want to be responsible for that. So I've largely limited my commentary to Bitcoin because I can't move the Bitcoin price. Trust me.
Right.
Like, no matter what I say, it's not going to move the Bitcoin price. Try as I might.
Right.
So I limited Bitcoin and actually Ethereum and a little bit. I'm less fair with Ethereum than I am always with Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, I wanted to get... What's your take on Ethereum?
I don't like the unlimited supply. The numbers aren't enough for me. I know they're trying to move to proof of stake, but when it comes, we can have a look at what the supply looks like then. I'm not sure why, if you do the math, that we need so much Ethereum out there in terms of at that price. And so I'm still trying to get my head around that. So I don't know. It looks bullish to me. It looks extremely bullish to me. But again, I could be wrong. It's hard to call the top as well. You just have no idea. I mean, if there's irrational demand for a certain item, then it'll go up in price. It's one of those things. And at the end of the day, it needs to be used in the real world. And Ethereum is arguably a better technology. It's it's got a different use case to Bitcoin, I think. I think Bitcoin is a real long-term store of value. And I think Ethereum is a more of a, call it a settlement layer, smart contracts. It's very closer to what we're trying to do with Civic. So I respect Ethereum. And it's, again, price and value are always two things which people don't understand. Like, I don't hate Ethereum. I'm just not sure that the price is aligned with the value long term.
Do you have any price predictions for Bitcoin by the end of the year?
My price prediction for end of this year was $3,000.
Okay.
And I did say we should get there as slowly as possible.
Okay.
No one cares.
Yeah. We'll be there in like a day.
We'll see. But that was the prediction I made last year. And so I think my annual predictions have been spot on for 4 years now. So
okay.
We're pretty good.
Well, we'll check back in and see how you did. Okay. Well, where can people learn more about your work and get in touch with you?
VinnieLingham.com is my blog. I do a lot of blogging there. I'm at VinnieLingham on Twitter. And then Civic.com is my company. So check it out if you're a developer. Get hold of us. We'll love to figure out how to get you some tokens and how to get you up and running. And if you're a user, download Civic. We're going to be giving users tokens as well as part of the distribution. So, yeah, just try it out and tell people about it and use it and give us feedback and tell us how to make it better and how we can better protect your data.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Laura.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. Before you switch off this podcast, don't forget, go to surveymonkey.com/r/unchanged to give me your feedback. If you're interested in learning more about Vinny, check out the show notes, which are available on my Forbes page, forbes.com/sites/Laura Shin. Unchained comes out every other Tuesday. Please share the podcast with friends and on social media. And remember to review, rate, and subscribe to it in iTunes or your preferred platform. Thanks again for listening.